The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The Carabao Cup box is back and it's here to celebrate the following. Frank Lampard's kind of triumphant returning defeat at Chelsea, Arsenal scraping past Blackpool, a mouth-watering Middlesbrough-Burton quarter-final draw, and Spurs either ending their crisis or papering over the cracks after it emerged that their new stadium's going to cost another squillion pounds. As predicted in Spain, Julen Lopetegui gets the boot from Real, but Conte won't be taking charge. FIFA's desperation to ruin the 2022 World Cup even further gathers ground, and has punditry gone too far? We'll analyse Steve McMahon's analysis of Harry Redknapp's analysis of Gary Neville's analysis. All that on today's Football Supporters Federation nominated Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We have a panel today. Keaton says, is Lars being groomed to take over from one of Barry or Max? He's been fairly regular of late. Not that I'm complaining. What are your intentions, Lars, please?
My intentions are to be on the pod, but to not take over from anyone.
Okay, excellent. I'm just happy at the club, going from game to game.
I think I'm the one they call when someone else cancels. I can only assume there's been a lot of cancellations.
I'm not going to deny that. Do you get a lot of invites at sort of 7 a.m.?
The night before, yeah. That sort of thing. Yeah, yes, definitely. But no, I'll take it.
Paolo Bandini, nice to see you.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm pretty good, actually.
Barry noticed you had a ponytail this morning and wondered if that was part of a midlife crisis. Is that fair, Barry? I don't want to put words into your mouth.
I think that's pretty much what I said. I pointed out he'd moved to Brighton, got a ponytail and a dog, and that screams crisis to me.
I'm just astonished that Baz didn't notice it the previous time that I came in and also had it. So
no, I did notice it.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
At some point, will you go Alice Band? I mean, it'd be quite a footballery look for the pod.
You know, I have experimented with an Alice Band.
Okay.
But I find that they sort of tend to flex off over time and it just gets irritating. They don't sort of stay in place in the way that you imagine they would.
Yeah. Well, you'd have thought if footballers would like something to really stay in place.
It's possible that footballers are buying them from superior vendors to the local Boots where I bought mine. So it's possible there are better brands of Alice Band are available.
Producer Jonathan says, why not experiment with a haircut? He's had a month off. He's come back in spiky form.
Yeah.
Hey, Barry.
Hello.
Award nominated, respected 2 weeks ago. Nominated again to the Football Supporters Federation Podcast of the Year. We won it last year.
We did, yes. And the year before, I think.
So there's pressure on us to retain the crown.
Yeah, huge pressure. And we're up against some very stiff competition. Mm.
Now, also, that's question 7 in the voting. If you go down to question 9, and you know it's not for us, Barry, to mention the other work that we do has also been nominated, and let's face it, we're surprised.
I was so surprised that I voted for Hawksby and Jacobs radio show because I didn't even notice us, TalkSport, the warm-up with Max Rushton on the shortlist. So that's how shocked I was.
Mm. Anyway, please vote for both of them because it means I get to go up twice on stage and forget to mention Barry twice. Right, let's start. Well, look, the Carabao Cup was yesterday, but don't open the box yet, Barry.
Okay.
Because I want to just cover off Spurs losing to Man City on Monday, and then we'll sort of roll into their win over West Ham. And at the appropriate time, you can open the box. Lots going on at Spurs, Paolo. Wembley's going to cost a whole lot more. Obviously, there's no manager at Real Madrid, and Real Madrid are quite interested in Pochettino. The pitch is so bad at Wembley. It was a weird kind of game. Are Spurs in crisis or not in crisis?
They just won. Are we doing crisis after a 3-1 win?
Well, were they in crisis yesterday morning? And are they no longer in crisis, or is it probably somewhere in the middle?
I think somewhere in the middle. Although, yeah, that's probably slightly just me and my feelings on crises in football being slightly over suggested. I think that Pochettino saying that he's basically as unhappy as he's been since he's been there is pretty significant because his management has been a huge part of their success in recent times. He's a tremendous manager. I think him saying that at a moment when you know that Real Madrid are looking for a manager makes the stakes feel a little bit higher. I don't personally sort of see an easy way for that sort of link that's been drawn to come to fruition, because Daniel Levy has Pochettino tied to a five-year contract, and Daniel Levy is not a man who easily gives up assets of his for cheap. And I don't think Real Madrid at this moment in time are really looking to spend money on negotiating someone out of a contract, which is a pickle for them in general, because the other guy they've also been strongly linked with, Antonio Conte, also still has some ties to Chelsea that aren't cheap to unravel. So what Real Madrid are thinking is a slightly separate conversation, I guess. But yes, it's certainly something when your manager, who again has been sort of so integral to this project in recent times, who has taken you to a level that you hadn't been at before, playing consistently in the Champions League, says he's unhappy. And there are good reasons why he would be, with the stadium dragging on and not being able to spend the money in the transfer market that perhaps some rivals have in this last transfer window. But I think crisis is still pushing it a little far for me. I mean, they're fifth and only a few points off a pace that for the top four is far higher than it normally is. I think I saw something earlier saying the top four are basically, from one to four, you could say it's all more points than they've been in recent seasons.
I'm saving that stat for part three.
Okay.
Right. On the pitch, Lars, it was a strange game, wasn't it?
Yeah, as much as we talk about Tottenham, I felt that game more than anything told us something about where City are at the moment, because they're going away to what is still another top six rival on just an atrocious pitch, which doesn't suit any of the teams, but suits City particularly badly. And they didn't play very well, City, but they still got out of there with a 1-0 win. And afterwards, you have Pochettino, who's an ambitious and competitive guy, saying that he was proud of the fact that they made City suffer, and said that they're just on another level. And you had Mourinho saying the other week that City are on another level. And they are. Like, they are on a level now where they go away to other top six teams, play not very well, and still get a win pretty comfortably in the end. And that's kind of frightening for everyone else, I think.
It was comfortable, Barry, but you know, Spurs had a couple of great chances. Kane was put through and his first touch was incredibly heavy, which to me is actually almost an easier chance than Lamella's, which might have hit a little bubble. But Spurs could have got something.
They could have, but they didn't. And that's Spurs, isn't it? Them.
All right, Jamie Carragher.
But, you know, we were talking about how much they've achieved, but they haven't achieved a huge amount. They've developed a bit of a backbone, but they still haven't won anything, you know, and it's well documented. Pochettino is obviously a good manager. Spurs fans, I would imagine, would be bereft to lose him, but I could understand if he wanted to go to Real Madrid, because I'm not so sure Tottenham's ambitions match his.
Isn't the point that what he's achieved with the net spend, which is not a phrase I love saying particularly, but it is pretty extraordinary when you look at
I'm shaking my head.
The net spend, but it's also the fact that they always have to keep a lid on the wage budget. That's almost more restrictive in the long run. The correlation between wage budget and league finish is much tighter than the correlation between spend and league finish, because you get all kinds of weird things transfer fee wise, really. But the fact that he's competing with these other top teams with basically half the budget, and that's a very, very hard thing to do. And I get the criticism of not having won anything. That's true. But I mean, it's not like Juan de Ramos is remembered that much more fondly as Spurs because he won a League Cup. I mean, I think what Pochettino has done is much, much harder than fluking a League Cup one year.
Can I ask a football tactics question, Paolo? Spurs, a lot of the time, try to play it out from the back.
Yeah.
But they do it in this sort of weird way where either, like, none of the passes are quite good enough. So Lloris will pass it to Alderweireld and it'll end up with one of the other centre-backs, Sanchez, sort of right in the corner, then playing a blind ball to the fullback who's got a player pressing him from behind. And actually, they would just be better just knocking it long.
So there's undoubtedly been this sort of move, I suppose, led by teams like Man City being so effective at passing out from the back. You see more and more teams trying to do it. And it is true that not all teams can do it effectively. I would argue that Tottenham are a lot better at it than a lot of teams, and if they weren't, then they wouldn't be consistently in and around the top four. But I understand certainly where you're coming from, that in certain situations you watch a pass that's played into an awkward spot, that plays them into another awkward spot, and especially playing on a pitch as bad as Wembley has been. I mean, obviously, after that last NFL game being an extreme scenario, but it hasn't really been a good pitch for very often this season. It can look like a bad idea, and I'm slightly loath to say oh yeah, just lumping it long will be the better option, because in the end, every one of these clubs now is doing a huge amount of analysis into the likely outcomes of every different kind of ball playing,
right.
And they will know that by passing it out from the back, they are improving their chances of building an attack. But it is true that if you're not putting the ball in the right places back there, if you're not getting those passes right to begin with, then you can very quickly put yourself in a deep hole.
Was it confusing for you watching with the NFL markings, given that you're such a big fan?
It's funny because I'd been doing the live broadcast of the NFL on TalkSport 2 on Sunday, and we were sort of stood there in the press area at Wembley looking at the pitch and thinking, this is a joke. I mean, there's no way. And we were on air for a good couple of hours afterwards, and the ground staff were out quickly, right? There was a crew of people with mowers, with little sort of spiky sticks to fill in all the divots, with everything that you could think to try and get it better. But I mean, you can't fix a grass pitch in less than 24 hours when it's been completely shredded up the middle.
Not even with spiky sticks.
With spiky sticks, I know.
The professional.
I know. There's probably a more accurate way of describing that, but I have no idea what it is because I've never done it. Rollers as well. You know, they were trying to fill it in, but the middle of the pitch was obviously disgraceful, you know, just because of the way the NFL works. The action happens in the middle of the pitch, so you have the hash marks, and between those two hash marks, that's where every play is starting. So every play, you've got a minimum of 7 or 8 guys lining up and putting their feet in the dirt there and making sort of sharp, explosive movements off the start, which tends to dig things up more. And then the other issue was just the width of the pitch, which I guess everyone saw. They have huge sidelines in the NFL, right? Because you have 11 guys on the field, but you have a 53-man roster, you have a vast number of coaches, you have guys using heavy computer equipment, you have a medical tent, you have everything. And the width of the pitch is much more narrow. So this technical area, which is vast, has a whole sort of section with a artificial turf laid over it, which is just getting trampled the whole pitch, which has happened for 3 weeks running, which, by the way, shouldn't have happened 3 weeks running because there should have been one game at Tottenham's new stadium where Tottenham should also have been playing. It was a disaster waiting to happen that then did happen, and the fact that it came to this in the end, it's Tottenham's fault. It's the absence of a stadium which was supposed to be there for them to play and which was supposed to be there for one of the NFL games to be. It's no one else's fault but theirs. You do wonder though still whether there might have been, given the mess that everyone found themselves in, a logistical case for the FA or the Premier League saying, hey, should we do something differently here?
So my partner's take on it was slightly different. She looked at the screen and all the markings, and the NFL went, fuck's sake, these Americans, can they not clean up after themselves?
All right, so Spurs are set to borrow another $237 million to covering the costs of the new stadium build. Also, David Conn in today's paper has written a long piece about the local residents nearby. It's pretty complex. Please go and read it. Barry, Gary Neville versus Harry Redknapp versus everyone else. It's the analysis of analysis of analysis. Is football eating itself, or is, I mean, what is this?
Well, the analysis, I think, was far more entertaining than what was ostensibly a very forgettable game. Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher had a very entertaining row on Monday Night Football, a frank and extremely and increasingly shrill exchange of views, which ended up with both of them squawking in such high-pitched tones that I imagine only dogs could hear them. And I pointed this out on Twitter, and Gary Neville tweeted back, and you know, so dogs and me could, which doesn't make sense and isn't really funny. But, you know, Gary Neville, very entertaining as a pundit. So he was incredibly critical of Spurs. He said, Tottenham haven't won the league in my lifetime. Tottenham, for 30 years of our lives, were spineless and soft, flaky, rubbish. They were pathetic, you know. Obviously shares Sir Alex Ferguson's, you know, classic, lads, it's Tottenham team talk. And then Harry Redknapp called into
Alan Brazil.
Alan Brazil yesterday on TalkSport, and was very critical of Gary Neville's criticism. And I thought he had a fair enough point. You know, he pointed out the Spurs, much like his Tottenham team, because he clearly took it as a personal affront. He pointed out that Spurs under Pochettino have won nothing, which is true. And then Steve McMahon.
Yeah, it was on the debate.
Was on the debate on Sky. And I missed his criticism. He was critical of Harry Redknapp's criticism of...
No, I think he was critical of Gary Neville again.
Okay. And now Gary Neville's sort of getting a lot of amusement from the fact that the criticism of his criticism seems to have become more of a popular sport than the actual sport.
Well, JMO says, who do you think should analyse the Guardian's panel's analysis of Steve McMahon's analysis of Harry Redknapp's analysis of Gary Neville's
analysis?
It's an
interesting point. Well,
we have people who comment on Twitter and below the line on our blog page. So, there's no shortage of criticism of our criticism.
But Redknapp has previous on this, because there is a funny clip out there of a former friend of the pod, I guess, Rafa Honigstein, who I believe was lost in the divorce at some point, making the point in a BT studio that Spurs used to be very flaky and Pochettino's made them solid. And he made this point with Harry Redknapp sitting right next to him. And Harry Redknapp was clearly very, very insulted indeed. So this is something he cares about. What I thought was really annoying was Harry Redknapp bringing up this thing about Neville's Valencia experience going wrong, and because of that he should never criticise anyone, basically seemed to be his underlying point. And I'd like everyone who makes this point just to be strapped to a rocket and blasted into outer space, because it is just profoundly stupid. Then you could easily come back and say, I watched quite a lot of Harry Redknapp's QPR, he should maybe never talk about football ever again by that logic.
Well, I mean, the last rocket, didn't it fail to get up into the air? So, as long as it's well put together. And the international... It'd be quite fun to have Harry Redknapp and a lot of people on the International Space Station with a guitar, playing their songs, floating about him and Big Sam.
But he made
Ray Houghton, just... Even a Robbie Savage, you've never played the game in zero gravity.
But he made valid points about we had these players and those players, and that's fair enough. And what I would like to see, which would be great if someone had the time, I don't, was to find the statistics for how many times Spurs have surrendered leads under their previous managers compared to what they do now. That would be very interesting. Like, factual arguments are great in discussions.
Wow, so
saying
say that?
You were quite bad at a club once, so you shouldn't have an opinion, is not a valid argument.
Hey, Barry, open the box. I can't believe, Paolo, you've never heard that. So look, Spurs won at West Ham. Mark says, dare I say it, did Spurs look better last night without Kane and starting Son up front? Kane's playing more like a slow number 10 these days, and Ali's better in that position too. Anyone?
Well, I think Harry Kane sees himself as a number 10 and likes to have players in front of him, but I don't think that suits him. I don't think that's his position. But, Son has endured something of a goal drought. I think are these his first goals since he returned from the Asian Games or Asian Cup? But, I think it would be trite to suggest that Spurs are better without Kane, but Son is a very, very handy person to have on board or in reserve.
Yeah, I think Harry Kane is plainly not playing as well as he has in some recent seasons, but he's still comfortably their leading scorer this season. And I think we can sort of go a bit far down the rabbit hole of, oh, wouldn't it be better if he wasn't there? Because if you put him back, you're taking away from what he does best for the team. And where are you picking up those goals? Yeah, there are other players in the team who score some goals, but there is no one else who scores at the rate that he does.
And actually, the question doesn't really work because Llorente played up front anyway, so Son wasn't playing.
Llorente, who is... probably the one player in the squad or in the attacking mix you'd say is not a sort of fleeter footed, lighter, more mobile alternative to Harry Kane up front.
Anyway, Spurs go to Arsenal in the quarter final. Arsenal scraped past Blackpool 2-1. 16 years and 6 months between Arsenal's two goal scorers. Lischsteiner shithoused one in.
He did.
It was a lovely ball from Guendouzi and one from Emile Smith-Rowe, 18 years of old, so well done to...
I thought it was actually a lovely run from Lischsteiner for a player who's not normally sort of supposed to be there. That was a proper striker's run to get on with that.
No, it's a very good point.
I mean, it's a point for part three, but are we not looking forward to the possibility of Lischsteiner versus Salah at the weekend? I mean,
Or Xhaka versus Salah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah!
Just in terms of just putting the shithousery on the Egyptian, I think that would be fun.
Well, let's save that for part three.
Good thing.
Guendouzi was sent off. I mean, the second booking looked soft to me, Paolo. But I most enjoyed. He has a brilliant. I'm very surprised I've been booked face.
It's a great skill to have, that capacity for incredulity in moments where incredulousness is not required. It's going to be an interesting quarterfinal, isn't it? Because Arsenal-Tottenham, but Pochettino was talking after the Tottenham win about how great mates he is with Unai Emery. So the weird split between two sets of fans who are not so keen on each other and two managers who are both reasonably popular with their respective fan bases right now, but who might ruin it all by being friends.
It is interesting. You would imagine, given that they're playing each other and given the situation that Emery and Pochettino are in for very different reasons, that they both might play strong sides. I mean, they may not, obviously.
Yeah, I don't know
when that game comes with Europa.
Yeah,
as well.
I think they play each other in the league a short while before, a couple of weeks before. So, it obviously depends on exactly what mode you're in and whether you feel like your team needs a pickup, because getting hammered by your local rival is never a good look. But I can't imagine, in the context of what both teams are trying to achieve this season, I can't imagine it being made a priority.
Aaron Ramsey apparently will leave Arsenal at the end of the season on a free, after the club finally told him in person he will not be offered a new contract, as opposed to just by WhatsApp. As our Arsenal spokesman today, Paolo, how do you feel about that?
I think it's a shame. I think it's a shame because Aaron Ramsey is clearly a very talented footballer, and I think that probably at the same time, neither Wenger nor Emery, and Emery obviously hasn't had very long, has really seemed to find the best out of him in the same way as we see Wales do. I think that if your team is, as Emery's team very much appears to be, going to be based around Mesut Ozil, and with good reason, Ozil's playing very well for him lately, then it is hard to get them both into the same team. Of course, it's still not great business to lose a guy for nothing who has a clear market value, but the contract that was being talked about was a pretty huge one. So if you, as Lars was saying, need to think about your wage bill and that ends up being such a significant part of a team's success, then I can see how it happens.
Chelsea 3, Frank Lampard's Derby County 2. Shed loads of goals and shed loads of fun, Lars.
It was. It was very good. I feel for Frank Lampard, not just because there were two own goals here, but I mean, they lost points at the weekend against Middlesbrough after a last-minute comedy own goal as well. So they've had three own goals in two games now. So that's deeply unfortunate for young Frank. But I thought they looked good, Derby. I think they played with a lot of confidence. The guys, they all looked like they knew what they were meant to be doing, which I think always reflects well on the coach. They play
with pace, a real pace, don't they?
There's some really quick guys there, and they could have very easily, the ball hit the post. They nearly brought it to penalties. So, very good effort.
I thought it was fascinating sort of hearing, because Lampard was justified because he played very well, sort of full of praise for Tom Huddleston after the game. And I think it's always interesting when you hear managers, or indeed just it could be when they're still playing, but people who, especially I think when they're ex-pros, and they talk about individuals who they played with and recognizing that, and he talks about Huddleston basically playing with him in England and being like, oh yeah, this guy can really pass the ball. And it's sort of just, I don't know, a fascinating idea that he's now had the chance to go and become manager, and he's like, oh, I remember that guy who I used to play against. And weirdly brought into my head that when we were doing Guardian Top 100 a few years ago, very much at the tail end of Frank Lampard's career, when he was no longer even starting all the time for Chelsea and sort of on the bench, and I got Alessandro Nesta, I got to do the panel for us. And Nesta, I don't have to say this now because we never reveal who does the vote, so I've started, so I'm going to finish. I think Nesta had Lampard at something like number 3 at a time when I think Lampard wasn't even getting on other people's lists. But it's just that thing of he's played against him and he's thought, I know how good you are because I've done it. I just think it's sort of cool that he's been able to do that and then actually apply that thought into getting a player into his team and turning him into a really impactful player.
I wrote Huddleston is just, there are just some players you love watching. And I don't, maybe Absolutely. It's because pretty much everyone around him in that Derby side is running around like crazy. And that sort of helps Huddleston, but he's just doing his own thing at his own pace, and he can strike the ball beautifully with both feet. He's a lovely player.
But I feel for Huddleston a bit. Obviously, he's had a very good career and he's a great player. But you wonder if he's just came around like a decade or two too late, like before the game became so much about pace and athleticism. If he'd been around, such an incredibly naturally gifted guy, if he'd been around when the game was a little bit slower and a little bit less frenetic, I wonder if he'd had an even better career than he have had, because he's got so much ability.
Yeah, this is where my little not all footballers' English football radar goes off, and I think that maybe there are climates in which a player like Tom Huddleston could be made more of. I mean, look at De Rossi at Roma right now. He's not fast anymore. He doesn't even really put the boot in like he used to. He's just a very elegant passing deep lying midfielder, and he can do a very good job there.
It would have been very interesting to see him go to Serie A when he was, you know, near the peak of his powers, Huddleston. I think in the right setup he could have done really well.
Fabregas's third goal, right, VAR looked at it and there was so obviously a foul from Zappacosta. Did you think VAR didn't look at that, because the replay seemed to focus on stuff happening in the box? And the Derby players were incensed. And I looked at that going, I can't see how you wouldn't give a foul there.
Yeah, I agree with you. It seemed very much like there should have been a free kick on it. And I don't feel like I've done enough studious reviewing of how the English officials have been using VAR to pass judgment. I would say that in Serie A, where I've observed much more how they're using it, That sort of thing certainly has been called off before. You know, they should be looking at that at fouls in the build-up, or at least they would in Italy.
We should mention as well that, you know, Fikayo Tomori's own goal was funny, A, because it was funny, and B, because he's a Chelsea player, you know.
Congratulations, agent.
Unfortunately, I will, anyone who missed it, I think that it's still possible to find it on the internet, do find Jaden Bogle, the right-back's own goal from the weekend against Middlesbrough. It was even funnier.
Oh,
it was really, really good.
Chelsea played Bournemouth in the quarterfinals. Bournemouth beat Norwich 2-1. Junior Stanislas and Steve Cook's goals for them, earning them a place for the second quarterfinal place in 2 years. Norwich had some chances, pulled one back. Look, Bournemouth have 20 points, Barry, and a quarterfinal in the Carabao Cup. I'm not going to mention again that you said they were going to get relegated, but
you just did.
I just did. Eddie Howe is just doing such a great job, isn't he?
Yeah, he's fantastic. And it is strange that... Well, he seems happy at Bournemouth, and he's on very good money at Bournemouth. I think he just signed a contract extension. He's on £3.5 million a year, which is a decent wedge. But he, you'd have to say, he deserves every penny. And I think if he was a manager in Spain or France or Germany, he would definitely be at a much, much bigger club. And it puzzles me that none of the top six teams in England seem to have ever expressed any serious interest in having him manage them. I would imagine it's, or hope it's only a matter of time. Bournemouth fans will obviously won't want him to go anywhere, but the job he's doing there at a club with a stadium that has 10,000 capacities is absolutely remarkable. And the team he's assembled is really good to watch and full of excellent young players that he has improved. And, you know, David Brooks, case in point, came from Sheffield United. Mm-hmm. He's just been remarkable how good he is and how quickly he's adapted to Premier League football. And, yeah, you can't praise Eddie Howe enough, really.
And it's intriguing that they've actually changed a little bit this season, Bournemouth. They're sitting, I mean, they're not quite so possession happy. They're still very tidy with the ball, but they sit back a little bit more so that they can use the pace they have on the break with Fraser and like the own brand Liverpool forward line, as you like to call them. I do wonder if and when Pochettino leaves Tottenham, surely Eddie Howe needs to be on a short list there, because you can just see that being a very good fit.
Middlesbrough 1, Palace 0. Both sides made 8 changes. Lovely goal from Lewis Wing in the first half. Settled the game. Nice story, Louise Taylor writing in today's paper. Less than 18 months ago, Lewis Wing played for Northern League side Shildon and worked on a production line at the same time. So good for him. Story from the weekend about Wilfried Zaha getting racist abuse and threats. Sort of depressing story after... what was it, a dive or not? Either way, after the game against Arsenal, in reply, he said, "For all the people taking it one step further and being racist, wishing death on my family, I wish you and your families the best too." He said, "My life is still very good despite your hate." Son also got a bit of racist abuse, I think, last night at West Ham, and that's not the first time he's had that as well. People are idiots.
Yeah. That behaviour is illegal, and nothing has been done to police it. Social media companies are completely abdicate their responsibility to people like Wilfred or you know, you or whoever is getting abuse, and you just have to take it and get on with it. Hopefully it doesn't affect Wilfried Zaha. I know, you know, when you get abuse on Twitter, it's not racist abuse, but you find it quite funny, so do I when I get it. But not everyone is like that, and some people, it does have a very detrimental effect on them, and I would imagine it can get very wearing when it's happening on a consistent basis, but I'm not sure what can be done about it. But yeah, just a lot of people out there are really nasty and unpleasant, and it's quite depressing.
I know this is easier said than done, but clubs all profess to have zero tolerance towards racism. I mean, there are stewards at these games. It's not impossible to identify who is delivering. Well, the specific example from the West Ham game that was mentioned in social media, if someone is shouting things at Son, which is clearly identifiable as racist abuse, it shouldn't be impossible for the stewards to see who they are, have them immediately chucked out, and for the club to then ban them. I mean, this should be possible to do.
I mean, I completely agree with you, but it's not easy. You know, steward's life is a pretty thankless one, isn't it?
But clubs need to stop saying that they have a zero tolerance policy then, if they're not prepared to put the necessary resources into policing this, because then they don't, clearly. They have a very relaxed attitude towards it.
Middlesbrough will play Burton in the quarter-final. Burton won the Nigel Clough derby, beating Nottingham Forest 3-2 in a fun second half, 0-0 at half-time. Burton missed a penalty in the first half. Jake Hesketh scored a lovely volley as well to secure the win for the Brewers. Tonight, Man City play Fulham. And, of course, Leicester's cup tie with Southampton was postponed. So they will play each other in the other quarterfinal. Last to finish part one.
Just poor Fulham. They've conceded 15 goals in four games. What's coming up now? Yeah, let's play Man City. That'll be fun.
We'll see. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Sid in Spain with a Real Madrid update. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. This is part two on the 29th of November at the Emmanuel Centre in London. Barry, what's happening?
Football Weekly is appearing live on a stage in front of, hopefully, row upon row of expectant, happy people.
Me, you, Jonathan Wilson, and still TBC. It's very exciting.
Beside myself with excitement. Who the TBC is going to be?
It could be Paolo, it could be Loz, it could be Sid Lowe. And let's cross to him live. Sid, how are you?
Very well, thank you. What could be me?
29th of November, live show for The Guardian. Are you ruling yourself out, or are you in contention?
I don't know. Shall I issue a come and get me plea at this stage?
Oh, we'd love that, yes. Now, on Monday, Sid, you said, you know, we all thought Lopetegui was going to go, and he did go, and then we all thought Conte was going to come in, and he hasn't come in.
And I think I must admit, this is kind of a difficult one to get to the bottom of. Let's try and make this as clear as possible. After the Clásico on whatever day it was, Sunday, when they lost 5-1, when Sergio Ramos was asked about Conte and how Conte would manage a team with an iron fist, and Ramos effectively said, "That's not what we want." In fact, Ramos was really quite explicit in saying, "Oh no, don't bring him here." That was pretty much his response. The reason that everybody was saying that it was going to be Conte was because Real Madrid had said categorically in the off-the-record briefings, it is Conte. The fact that it wasn't Conte in the end opens up loads of questions, whether it fell through because of what Ramos said, whether it fell through because Real Madrid, at some point, the deal broke down, whether it fell through because Conte didn't want it to happen. Now, from Conte's camp, there is a sense that there wasn't a proper offer, that it wasn't done through the proper channels. And so it almost feels like somewhere along the line, this has been a charade, or somewhere along the line, something has gone horribly wrong. Anyway, long and short of it, it's not Conte, it's Solari for now, because he's officially an interim manager. And according to league rules, you can only be an interim manager for 2 weeks. So this hasn't finished yet. That's the sad answer to all of this. This still hasn't finished.
So I guess that the obvious follow-up on that Sid, is, does that mean that the Conte conversation is definitively dead, or could they come back to it? And then the other name, which I was curious to get a take on, and this could be purely a nonsense idea, but sort of dimly football romantic one, appealed to me because I know they pursued him in the past, is, do you think that there's any chance Arsene Wenger is on Madrid's radar at this point?
I find it, I mean, I'm never going to say never because Real Madrid have proven time and time again that you don't do that. I find it very difficult to imagine Wenger as the candidate. One scenario, I suppose, in which I could see that is that maybe Wenger comes in with a younger coach who hasn't yet got his badge, which essentially means Raul or Xabi Alonso. I don't think Xabi Alonso wants to come in as someone's number two. I think he wants to take this job when the time is right as number one. So I don't think that's very likely. Roberto Martinez is another name that's been mentioned, not least because Jorge Valdano, who of course is no longer anything to do with Real Madrid, but was once a sporting director, was talking on in the media at the weekend and said that he thought that, that Roberto Martinez was a man that would fit very well. Is the Conte conversation completely over? It feels like it. But I must confess, I'm not entirely sure by that. And this does feel like a process in which you get Solari in, you buy yourself a couple of weeks, and then you keep on talking. And there's no doubt that they are continuing to talk to various managers. But the truth is that the answer to, you know, do you know who Real Madrid's next manager is going to be? The answer to that is no. And the answer to that would be no if you ask Real Madrid's board of directors as well, because they still don't know where this is going to end up.
Sid, Sergio Ramos seems to yield an unhealthy amount of power at the club, which is fine up to a point, but on the pitch he's turning into a liability. Would they be better off getting rid of him?
Well, I mean, this is a key question, and it's a key question, and at the risk of making this sound complex, and I'm going to try and unpack it for you. Sergio Ramos, and not just Sergio Ramos, but the player power at Real Madrid is something that concerns the president, and the president wants to try and challenge that. And that part of the idea of, you know, Conte coming in was this was going to be an iron fist. And this is, of course, what Ramos came out and basically said, we don't want this. And he came out and the phrase he used was, respect is to be earned, not to be imposed. Now, I suppose you could argue, well, hang on. If you're the manager, by definition, you should automatically be respected the minute you walk in. And what Ramos is effectively saying is, well, whoever comes in, let's see how he earns our respect. That is something that the president is very keen to try and control the dressing room a bit more. And this is one of the contradictions at the heart of Real Madrid, is that there is a desire to impose upon this group of players, but a concern as to the consequences of trying to do so, and you know how that then plays out. So when you get something like Ramos's comment at the weekend, you then have a situation where, in a way, that maybe emboldens the president to say, "Well, look, see, there he is speaking out of turn. That's not for him to say. Let's do this." But at the same time, I think, yeah, but if we do, what happens? What if this really blows up in our faces? And so I think that does provide a kind of a contradiction, which is complex and difficult to work out in terms of the purely footballing element of it. I personally think there's been a certain taboo in Spain over the last two or three years, and in particular with the national team, perhaps even more with Real Madrid, about Sergio Ramos, and a failure to point out his poor performances at key moments. And yet it is also true, and this is something, by the way, that a friend of Ancelotti said to him in the first few weeks of the season when Ancelotti first took over. He said, God, what's going on with Ramos? And a friend of his says, don't worry about it. Come April or May, he'll be the best defender in the world. And come April or May, he almost always is. Mm. There's something about Ramos and something about him that has this ability to be absolutely right in those key moments, which perhaps isn't beneficial when you want to win the league, because, of course, you've got to win the league across 38 games, not just across three or four of them. But when it comes to the Champions League, by the final, by the quarterfinals, by the semifinals, he's almost always extraordinary.
Sid, I guess the other question that I'm curious about in this managerial hunt is, how much is money going to be a factor or not a factor? Like, are Madrid going to be tight on what they're willing to spend to release someone, or is it money no object because you've got to get the right guy situation?
Well, I mean, for example, as I understand it, you know, the initial kind of conversations with Conte included an offer which wasn't financially that great. Mm. Now, obviously, I must confess, I don't know at this stage how decisive that eventually was in terms of the deal breaking down. We tend to have this image of Real Madrid as being a club where money is no option. No problem at all, no issue. But over the last 4 or 5 years, look at what they've signed and what they haven't signed, and it quite clearly has become an issue. They've invested less money over the last 4 years since the last Galactico, which was James Rodriguez, than both Barcelona and Atletico Madrid, for example. Both in terms of actual spend and in terms of net spend. Of course, they're now committing to a €500 million stadium redevelopment, which has an impact there as well. I think in managerial terms, it shouldn't be a huge issue. And certainly if it meant getting absolutely the man they want, then they would go for it. But I think the criteria, that's only one of the criteria and only one of the obstacles. In the summer, for example, when they tried to go for managers to replace Zidane, which is why they got to Lopetegui in the first place, they had managers basically looking at this and thinking, well, with a squad that's now that's now kind of reached a point of satiation, if that's a real word in English, I've completely forgotten how to speak English. The point that's no longer got that, squad that's no longer got that hunger, that's just won three European Cups. I'm not following Zidane. You must be mad. Yeah. And lots of managers didn't really fancy that. Allegri didn't fancy it. Obviously, Pochettino did, but he had only just signed a new contract with Spurs, so that was difficult. Jurgen Klopp didn't much fancy it, although I suspect that was more to do with Liverpool than to do with Real Madrid. A couple of other managers that they'd gone for as well had this same sort of mentality. Now, of course, that situation has shifted because you've now got that buffer zone of failure between Zidane and whoever comes in next. But you're also, what are we, three months into the season and not many managers are available, not many managers are going to want it now. And so it may well be, and I suspect this is quite likely to be the case, that there is a solution to the end of the season and then a new look in the summer. But as I say, the financial element will only be one of the many obstacles that they face.
Sid, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. Fit Bar. Jim writes, what's your favourite bit of guru? Get it right up ye. By a player or manager who's been getting it tight from the wee sensitive lambs in the stand you have ever seen. Hashtag Fit Bar Corner. Could you elucidate on what that question means?
Well, I am assuming it's a reference to Neil Lennon goading Hearts fans last night in a very, very entertaining Edinburgh derby between Hearts and Hibs. Finished scoreless, but nonetheless, I watched it. That's why I was so quiet during the West Ham derby chat, because I didn't see that game. It was highly entertaining. Blood, thunder, muck, bullets and missiles. Just on the field, Hearts were injury ravaged, missing Stephen Naismith. Very, very light up front. Stephen Naismith is out for several weeks now. And they already had...
Uche Ikpeazu's out as well, isn't he?
He is.
Big Uche.
And it looks like they might lose Steve McLean soon to retrospective punishment for grabbing a Celtic player by the ghoulies last weekend. But... And interestingly enough, McLean says that he's been doing it for years, but apparently it's only turned into a punishable offence since last summer. So they're about to lose him for two games. But I digress. Hibs had the best chances during the game. Stevie Mallon went close with two free kicks, and he also hit the bar with a long-range effort. Hearts had a goal disallowed for offside correctly. And when that goal was disallowed... Neil Lennon, a shrinking violet that he has always been, turned to the Hearts fans with whom he's had a long and fractious relationship and sort of gave them a load of, up yours because their goal was disallowed. At which point, someone in the crowd threw a pound coin and hit him in the face and he went down injured. And
the thing is, right? Obviously, and it's a bit like, the racist abuse. You're an idiot. People throwing coins are idiots, right? There is a split now between whether what Neil Lennon's doing is funny and it's just part of the pantomime of football and he's having a bit of a laugh, or should he be really sort of serious and behave like a manager should behave?
He probably shouldn't do it, but it is funny. And it's a classic example of the football fans who are happy to dish it out for 90 minutes, but as soon as someone gives them a bit back, they clutch their pearls and swoon like Victorian ladies. And in the case of one idiot, throw a pound coin. Like during the game, the two assistant referees were also struck by missiles, and the Hearts goalkeeper, Bobby Slamel, was punched by a fan as he went to retrieve the ball. This is unacceptable behaviour. Craig Levein and Neil Lennon both were very critical of the fans, their own, and happy to criticise their own fans who misbehaved after the game. Levein said, look, you can swear and shout and do whatever you want, but you can't resort to violence. And any fan who suggests that Neil Lennon deserves to get hit by a coin, and he is a very divisive character in Scotland, always has been, it's just talking nonsense.
Do you think managers coming out and saying that will help? Because we were talking about England before and the behaviour of England fans out in Spain.
I don't think it will help because there is a section of fans that follow every football team who are just complete antisocial knuckleheads, and there is no getting through to them.
On that, Ewan Murray was tweeting about the McLean grabbing the player by the ghoulies, underused word, I'd say. And he sent a tweet earlier this week saying, if the SFA are following rules re McLean, fine. The key issue is a bonkers scenario whereby that is a ban, yet willfully kicking an opponent isn't a ban. To which Harry Slay replied, head and genitals are treated differently for violent conduct. I'm surprised, as a well-informed journo, you're not aware of this. Please show me in the laws of football that they are treated differently. What happened elsewhere, Baz?
It's been a very eventful week in the world of FITBA. Aberdeen beat Hamilton 3-0 last night. Pretty straightforward victory. But Derek McInnes, the Aberdeen manager, has warned fullback Shay Logan about the company he keeps after Logan... One of Logan's mates posted a Snapchat of Logan saying, fuck the Rangers, in a car after Aberdeen had beaten them last Sunday in the League Cup. Logan has previous... He's very unpopular also with Celtic fans because Alexander Tonev, years ago, while on loan at Celtic, was banned for 7 games for racially abusing Logan. So it's nice, if nothing else, that Logan is doing his bit to bring harmony... to the old firm and unite the factions in their mutual hatred of him. So well done, Shay.
Wait, he's unpopular because someone racially abused him?
Yes.
Right.
And he has...
well done, fans, I have to say. That's great.
I should probably add that Tonev did appeal the decision, emphatically denied racially abusing him, but the ban was upheld. And Logan has since... accused Celtic fans of racially abusing him when he was sent off in a game.
Mm. Producer Jonathan points out it's like Aaron Ramsey being unpopular in Stoke.
I always had this in my head, like, as if you're a dad and you've taken your 11-year-old son to a Stoke game and everyone's booing Ramsey, how do you explain to your kid that we're booing this guy because one of our players broke his leg and that's why we don't like him? Like, what...
I mean, I think there's quite a few awkward conversations between parents and young kids at football games, to be fair. I remember being in the clock end at Arsenal when a lot of Arsenal fans were chanting Chelsea rent boy at Ashley Cole, which is not especially charming chant, and a kid in front of me turned to his dad and saying, Dad, what's a rent boy? And his dad declining to answer that question in that moment in time, but I imagine that was probably one of those wonderful questions that would keep recurring as you're on the way home, as you're trying to go to school the next morning. And
yeah, I should specify, I wasn't laughing at the chant's not on, but the idea of trying to explain it to a kid is very funny.
Yeah.
On the Stoke news, James McLean is...
just one other thing. Yeah. Celtic swatted Dundee aside, bottom of the league, Dundee 5-0 last night. 5 different scorers for Celtic. Tom Rodgick, Scott Sinclair, Forrest, Edward and Ryan Christie. And Lee Griffiths is back in the news again because he wasn't in the squad. He hasn't played since, I think, 7th of October for club or country. You'll remember he withdrew from the Scotland squad saying he wasn't fit. And there seems to be a feud simmering between him and Stephen Naismith because Griffiths has now got himself in trouble, having previously liked a tweet that was critical of Naismith and Alex McLeish. He has liked a series of tweets making fun of the fact that Stephen Naismith injured his knee last Sunday and will be out for 6 weeks. And Ali McCoist has said, you know, there's something very peculiar going on with Lee Griffiths at the moment, and no one's quite sure what. But he hasn't played for Celtic for a month. There were rumours that he hadn't been turning up for training, rumours which Brendan Rodgers sort of denied. And yeah, there is something weird going on there. And finally, Rangers drew 1-1 with Kilmarnock, and Steven Gerrard is very, very frustrated with the lack of firepower Rangers have, and has basically warned his players that they're over-reliant on Alfredo Morelos, no one else is scoring, and he's not happy with them. And at a press conference before that game, he said, it was quite impressive, actually.
Yeah, he did. He came across really well because a player was asked a question.
It was Jordan Rossiter, who looks about 11.
Yeah, and Stephen went, I'll answer this one. And yeah, I thought he spoke very well, didn't he?
He said, basically, Jordan Rossiter was asked, you know, your manager he was quite critical of the team and the fact they're not scoring goals. And a reporter asked Jordan Rossiter, you know, what's it like to get that warning? Or what's it like to get that criticism? And Gerrard sort of cut across Rossiter just as he began to answer the question and said, I'll answer that. It's a warning. At a big club, you expect big players to step up on big occasions and provide big moments. And his players aren't doing that. And he's said that they will be replaced unless they start stepping up.
As I mentioned, Stoke and James McLean, listen, the poppy, he's not going to wear a poppy, deal with it. If I can point you in the direction of David Squire's cartoon about Poppygate, it is absolutely, I hope I'll get him to tweet it out again. It was from a couple of years ago, I think. It's just absolutely brilliant. And he's got a book out, which is great. And we're going to talk to him at some point on the pod between now and Christmas. Hey, the World Cup could be extended early. Qatar 2022 could have 48 teams. It might not all be in Qatar. They could just go to some other countries. Why not?
Bring Gianni, back
Gianni Infantino.
Bring him back.
Gianni Infantino said, producer Jonathan says, much like this podcast. Are we going on too long, Jonathan? You know, you haven't edited anything for a month. You should enjoy this. Infantino says, it'll happen in 2026, the expansion to 48 teams. Will it happen in 2022? You know me. It is possible. It is possible. He's sounding more and more like Donald Trump, isn't he? Just sort of his phraseology. I mean,
this idea of giving it to the neighbouring countries is completely insane, even by FIFA standards. It's like the idea, we're now going to give the World Cup to host countries that no one's been voted for at all because the one they did vote for isn't able to cope with the changes they've suddenly decided to make. I mean, the bring back Sepp thing is, it's almost not a joke anymore. It's so ridiculous.
I mean, at least if they move it to other countries that, you know, we could hope get a bit more skullduggery and you know, dodgy voting as you know, for the neighbouring countries that they go for.
As long as the outcome isn't as insane as this, and it's just,
will they play in the winter in Qatar, but in the summer in Saudi Arabia and the UAE?
Pretty much the same climate in the surrounding countries there, Max, I have to tell you.
Yes, I know.
Do you?
Yes.
but you do feel like you could imagine Infantino turning around saying, "We're going to do this over a whole year. We're going to spread it out. We're going to take over more seasons. We're going to..."
But just regarding this idea of expanding the World Cup, it's a very classic case of what they call in social sciences the tragedy of the commons, because all the individual actors, they look at this as a good thing because they think if there are more spots, we have a better chance of being in there, which means more, you know, more trips for the lads and more money because the... Yeah, and all this. But the end result will be that the whole thing is diluted. We won't have this thing where... Part of what's special about the World Cup is that you remember all the teams that were in there and you remember something about them, even the puny ones. Whereas if you make it bigger, then it'll just, you won't, and you'll lose that, and it'll become less valuable for everyone.
It's time to play. Can Lars remember all the teams in the World Cup this summer?
This summer, I'd say so, probably.
It's worth reinforcing, like, what this is, you know, what the bottom line is here and what the whole bottom line is, you know, with Infantino and his role there. FIFA has... it has control over the world international game, which you think should be able to make it super wealthy because it's controlling the most beloved sport in the world. And what they're doing is thinking, well, we actually don't monetize this nearly as much as we could, and how can we get more money out of this game? Because actually, without the World Cup, they really don't bring in that much money, FIFA. And so that's the same thing that's going on with this discussion of an expanded Club World Cup. It's all effectively a money grab and also a power grab. And that's going to get kickback, as it already has with the club situation, from other bodies such as UEFA or all the other regional bodies that also are interested in their own power base, in their own financial prerogatives. But yes, to an extent, as Lars just said, everyone can look at this and go, oh, there's more chance of more teams in there and more money, and it all sounds great for everybody. But, like, I mean, that is, in the end, what it's all about. It's all about money. It's all about money and power positioning and not about football at all, sadly.
And this club competition, like, on the great list of things the sport needs right now, I think a big club competition run by FIFA, possibly funded by the Saudis, not very high on that list, I'd say.
In the Women's Champions League, Chelsea eased into the quarterfinals after a 6-0 win at Fiorentina. Frank Kirby scored a hat-trick. They won 7-0 on aggregate. Chelsea, the only WSL side left in the competition, also through Lyon, Wolfsburg, PSG, Bayern and LSK from Norway. Ooh. Barcelona and Slavia Prague, favourites to join them tonight. Paolo?
It was 6-0 on aggregate. I'm being pedantic, but it wasn't 7. Oh, wait. No, I'm sorry. I've got the wrong thing. I'm being pedantic wrongly.
I'd like to keep that in.
Keep it in, please. I don't mind.
Producer Jonathan quickly losing the will to live here now.
There we are. Paolo Bandini.
I don't mind being
pedant
wrong.
And idiot.
Yeah.
And that's a great way to end part two. Back in a minute.
I don't mind being wrong. I really thought it was six.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's look ahead to the Premier League fixtures. Leicester City's game against Cardiff will take place. Since Monday's pod, Vichai's son, Top, has pledged to continue his father's work in Leicester. He put up this post. What happened made me realise how important my dad was to many people all over the world. I've received a very big mission and a legacy to pass on, and I intend to do that. A difficult decision for Leicester City to play the game. They've said they're not going to fly. They're going to take a coach down on Friday, but that game at Cardiff goes ahead. There was a stat which you brought up earlier in the pod. Hugh Davies, I saw putting it first, saying Liverpool have the most points of any team in second at this stage of the Premier League. Chelsea have the most points of any team in third. Arsenal the most of any points in fourth. The most of any in fifth. Spurs, Bournemouth and Watford sixth and seventh. The week are getting weaker. And David sent a tweet today going, Watford's points tally now in seventh is the same as Leicester in 15-16 when they won the league, Man City in 13-14 when they won the league, and even United in 98-99 when they won the treble. What, I don't know if these are just surprising statistics or what does it mean?
I don't know. I mean, it immediately calls to my mind, because inevitably I always turn my mind back to Serie A, that last season Napoli finished second with 91 points. You know, this is, I think, a trend that could be identified to a certain extent across Europe, is that the very richest are pulling themselves further apart. It's interesting that in England it goes down so far. It's not just one or two teams pulling themselves further apart. It's a whole sort of cadre of teams that are separating themselves in a way that's quite dramatic. Is it a one-off this season, or is it a trend? We don't want to sort of get too far ahead of ourselves, because exactly the point that statistic makes is it hasn't happened before. But it does feel like the gap between the haves and the have-nots is wide, and perhaps not just in England at the moment.
Most of those, by the way, have played three or four games against teams in the top 10, three or four games, and the rest in the bottom 10. Maybe it's a quirk of the fixture list. It's possible. I suppose game of the weekend is, as we mentioned before, Arsenal-Liverpool. It is fascinating to see, you know, if Xhaka and Lichtsteiner play, or one of them or both, against Mane and Salah. Could be fun.
Yeah, no, without getting all boring and tactical, I think that's one of the really fascinating aspects of this game, is one of the things, or part of the things Unai Emery has done so far in Arsenal, is the system. They push the fullbacks really far up, and which against Liverpool, with the pace they have on the flanks, could get very interesting. And they also play out from the back, which we talked about earlier. Some teams are good at and some teams aren't, and you get the sense that Arsenal aren't brilliant at it yet, playing against the potentially high pressing Liverpool. That's also a slightly terrifying prospect.
Yeah, Lichtsteiner has been caught out a good number of times this season already for pace. He's also not a natural left back, which is sort of amplifying it. I think that if he does start there, it's got a high potential for disaster. But equally, Granit Xhaka's not a left back, so that's clearly a point at which you can imagine the game being decided is maybe slightly strong, but certainly being a key factor in the game.
But a fascinating point there is that one of the things Arsene Wenger was criticised for all the time was that he didn't adapt his tactical plans to the opposition. Mm. Unai Emery, of course, is regarded as a much more flexible tactician. Maybe he'll come up with something really clever.
Bournemouth-Manchester United, Barry, is interesting as well, isn't it? The early kickoff on Saturday. Rumours that Jose's going to get a £100 million war chest in January. Bournemouth are favourites for this, aren't they?
Well, I don't know.
Well, they are in my mind. Maybe they're not. I don't know.
Not with the bookies, no.
I'd imagine they probably aren't. But, I mean, every Manchester United game is interesting at the moment because you just don't know what you're going to get at all. But you have a fair idea what you're going to get from Bournemouth. And, again, I thought, who was it they played last week? Fulham?
Yeah.
I was fairly confident they'd tear Fulham apart, and they did. And while Manchester United's defence has improved in recent games, Bournemouth are one of the most exciting attacking sides. You know, their front line, you can see them causing any team in the division all kinds of problems. And on a bad day, you can see them absolutely tearing into Manchester United's defence. So, yeah, I certainly wouldn't bet against Bournemouth in this game.
small signs of recovery from United, though, the last couple of weeks, I thought. They've not been great, but they've been marginally better, and the players don't appear to have quit on Mourinho in the manner that, say, the Chelsea players did in his third season there. And we were here talking a few weeks when we were at, like, peak United crisis, that Mourinho has never turned a situation like that around in his career, and they've not completely turned it around yet, but they're certainly on the right path, and they are actually just like 5 points off a Champions League spot now, so this season is still salvageable for them.
I think the thing that just remains so astonishing with this United team, you compare it to last season, a lot of people found United uninspiring last season, but they did still finish second, and the thing was they were still essentially very reliable at the back. They've scored fewer than Bournemouth, but they've also conceded five more than Bournemouth. I think that's what's sort of so surprising. Man United are not, after 10 games, sort of in any statistical category, which is not, of course, the only way we should judge football, but are better than Bournemouth. I still kind of expect them to win this weekend because it's United and you sort of think, well, yeah, there have been some signs of recovery and won't they, a quarter of the way through this season, start to buck their ideas up? I do think that the other sort of slightly intriguing factor about this one is that Bournemouth have, while playing some pretty attacking football, have tended to be a counter-attacking side this season. Even against Fulham, I believe they had less than 50% possession. They let Fulham have the ball and hit fast enough. But United tried to play counter-attacking football, which is another thing.
The ball will just sit on the halfway line.
Yeah,
it'll be like table football where no one's getting it.
Yeah, but yeah, which of course, you know, is part of what is frustrating their fans so much is the unwillingness of Mourinho to try and take control of games and you know, be Man United and act with sort of swagger and control. So yeah, it's definitely going to be an intriguing one this weekend.
Everton play Brighton, Newcastle play Watford. Newcastle have announced this morning that their captain Jamal Lascelles has signed a new 6-year contract, so that's good for them. West Ham
with the greatest respect to Newcastle, I think it's only a matter of time before he goes to a bigger, more ambitious club, and I would imagine that contract is just to jack up his fee.
Are you saying they're not worth the paper they're written on, Barry?
Who, Newcastle?
No, contracts in general.
All right. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying Jamal Lascelles will not be at Newcastle for the next 6 years, put it that way.
Let's start a timer and see.
With Newcastle, though, at what point does it become legitimate to start to question some of the work Benitez is doing?
Because never.
I know, like, he's been dealt a bad hand by Mike Ashley, and Mike Ashley is the devil and all of this. But come on, it's not like he's working with just random Geordies off the street. Like, he does have a team that should be capable of doing more than no wins and 6 goals in the last 10 games now.
Do you hate them more than Burnley?
Don't hate anyone, mate.
Your nemesis, Burnley, they go to West Ham. Wolves Spurs, 7:45 kickoff on Saturday night.
Ooh.
How do we feel? I mean, Lars, clearly excited.
Very excited.
Everyone else?
I am fundamentally against it, but...
Oh, I know why. I like why.
Hmm?
I like why you're against Saturday late kickoffs.
Why am I?
Before you've said because as a casual Saturday afternoon drinker, by 7:45 in the evening, you're not in any way sort of compos mentis enough to notice what's going on.
Well, I'm actually working this Saturday, so I will be, there'll be no casual drinking in the afternoon.
There'll be hard drinking instead.
Well, I'm more of a casual Sunday afternoon drinker, to be honest. So
a late Sunday kickoff was the worst.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just sort of feel by 8 o'clock, if you're watching telly, it should be, a terrible reality TV program, or you should be out.
Or MLS.
or resting to make sure you're on peak performance for your award-nominated radio show the following morning.
And, you know, late on a Saturday night, away fans going, you know, it's... Should I be less down on this, Paolo?
I think of all the categories who probably might actually enjoy it, the travelling away fans are probably quite high on the list. Because you go out to a game, you have some drinks before the game, you have some drinks after the game. If you want to spit on after that something even more, you can do it.
It's better than a Monday night.
That's the group who are probably least fussed about it, but for everyone else, perhaps.
I'm not too well up on Wolverhampton nightlife, but what is there to do there for the discerning Tottenham Hotspur fan looking for some entertainment?
I've been out in Wolverhampton once for a concert, which is about 17 or 18 years ago.
Who was playing? Should we guess?
I can't even remember is the sad part.
Shed 7?
No, it was like a ska band. But
the Specials? I'm out.
They're from Coventry, aren't they?
Yeah.
I honestly can't remember. I remember who I went with.
That's less interesting for anyone else.
Exactly.
Did you go night clubbing afterwards?
No, I don't think so.
Manchester City play Southampton on Sunday. James says it's Mark Hughes' birthday today. Do you expect he moaned at his presence when he woke up? Chelsea Palace on Sunday as well. On Monday, Huddersfield v Fulham. So, you know, you can have Monday off. The most common scoreline, writes producer Jonathan, in the Premier League so far is a 2-1 away win.
Oh. I think Huddersfield Fulham could be fun because they're both quite desperate. And
neither of them can defend.
Fulham certainly can't defend. Huddersfield, if they carry on like they did against Watford, I mean, I think that'll be fun.
Stoke Middlesbrough in the Championship is the Tony Pulis derby. Now on to something that's really got me exercised this morning, the Copa Libertadores. For the first time ever, the final will be the Super Clásico, River Plate versus Boca. So that is good. But in the River Plate semi-final against Gremio, it was 1-1, and so River Plate weren't going through. And the ref gave a penalty for handball against Gremio in the 88th minute. It wasn't taken till the 95th minute because of the complaints. The referee had to be defended by armed guards after the game, you know, which is taking it too far. But if you've seen this handball, the River Plate guy volleys it. The man's hand is out and it brushes the top of his hand. It's exactly where your arm would go if you spin to block a ball. Your arm goes out. It doesn't stay by your sides unless you're a weevil, right? And it's really, you know, I went on Twitter this morning and everyone's like, well, that's an unnatural position. I don't know the rules, Lars.
No one does.
Don't weevils live in biscuits?
Well, you know those things you push over and they bounce back up again? What are they?
Wobbly man.
Oh. Luka Modric.
Well, that's also just one of those.
The things that you push over and bounce back.
You know,
again.
those little toys.
Yeah, but weevils, you know, if you were a Portuguese explorer, the biscuits on your ship would be infested with weevils, rendering them inedible.
Committing handballs.
What do I mean then?
There was in the Noddy books.
A weeble, right? Not a weevil, a weeble. They're those funny little toys that you push over and they just bounce back up again. Here are some weebles for the studio audience.
I think in the Enid Blyton's Noddy books, which are rather politically incorrect these days, but there was a character called Mr. Wobbly Man who was similar to the weeble of which you speak.
Fans of South American football would be delighted with the direction this conversation.
Anyway, what do you think? It was a handball?
I have no idea anymore because, okay, so if we learned one thing over the VAR thing during the World Cup is that no one knows what a handball is anymore. Because before, with handball decisions, you could always say, oh, he had a strange view, oh, that's how he saw it. But now they all go to the monitor and they see it 50 times and they come up with decisions that don't make sense to anyone. And in the we can have these endless discussions on social media, and that's a fun way to waste time. But the thing I think is interesting is that in the summer, you had so many qualified referees and recently retired top referees coming up with completely contradictory conclusions as to what is and what isn't handball. And that suggests to me that the rules and how they're implemented is far too vague. And I've just given up. Like, and I don't know what it is anymore.
And also, for me, in the semi-final of the Copa Libertadores in the 88th minute, you need to be more certain of a handball than in the first minute of a League Two match, which is obviously completely ridiculous. This is only the third time a continental club competition has had a final between two clubs from the same city. The Champions League has had two Madrid derbies. And this is the last ever two-legged final. So a perfect way to end that tradition. On to the goodbyes. I got forwarded this Jim White tweet many times. An interview 2 years in the making. Charlton fans, take note. My exclusive interview with Roland de Châtelet goes out at 11:30 on Monday morning. I was doing the pod, so I've not heard it. But I'd have thought, I love Jim, but that's to use 2 years to try and get that. Hopefully Roland said something interesting. On Pereira's terrible Maisie dribble goal for Watford, Paul says, would it be sacrilegious to suggest that Ricky Villa's cup final goal would be an example of an overrated Maisie goal? Anybody want to nail their colours to that mast?
Oh, I'd need to see it again, to be honest. But I would imagine he had more work to do than Pereira, who really didn't have to do any dribbling. He just
I know what he means. A lot of people have said about that Ricky Villa cup final goal that it's, you know, the greatest ever, and it's good, but it's not Maradona 86, right?
But it's also, it's a cup final, which gives it, you know, an extra couple of points, I think.
That's a fair point. Owen said, on Monday's pod, Adam asked if Pogba was a proclaimer, how long would it take him to walk 500 miles? Owen has done the maths. 10 seconds from the 18-yard line to the spot is 1.23 miles an hour. 500 miles in 17 days, plus 17 more days. It's all for naught, though, if he picks up a second yellow falling down at your door. Thank you, Owen. And Jan, a lad on work experience, sent a photo of us podding last week. And Jordan writes, I'm disappointed to see there are laptops. I was always hoping for copious amounts of post-it notes and page-a-day diaries, convinced there was a mid-pod doodling going on and maybe Lars flicking through a takeaway menu. It just goes to show you should never see how a sausage is made.
Well, you can always post my notes, which are covered in doodles, which I drew while Sid was on. I don't use a laptop when I'm in here.
You're saying you never listen to Sid?
No, I was listening to Sid. I can listen and doodle at the same time.
Oh, what a talented put that on your TalkSport singles profile, along with being proficient at cutlery, Baz. And thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Cheers, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Paolo.
Cheers.
Back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.